"Thou mayst keep the sheep," said Laban. And thus it was between them several times, until Laban preferred to say nothing and let Jacob do as he would, for he was unwilling that his nephew should weary in well-doing, and so had to give way. But he was glad when the water system was finished, the pond filled, the garden planted, and the field enlarged, and he could send Jacob out with the sheep, away from the court, first near at hand, then further away, so that for weeks and months at a time he came not under Laban's roof, but set up his own light shelter against sun and rain out on the plain, near a spring, and made pens of clay and wattle, and a temporary tower for refuge and lookout. There he lived, on scanty fare, with his crook and his sling, and, with the dog Marduka, guarded the scattered herds and yielded himself to time, talking to Marduka, who pretended to understand him, and in part did so, watered his beasts and penned them evenings in the folds, suffered heat and cold, and got but little sleep, for the wolves howled at night after the lambs, and sometimes even a lion crept upon them, and Jacob had to make the noise of 20 men with rattle and shouting to drive the robber away. Of Laban's increase. When he drove home the sheep, a day's journey or so, to give accounting to the master of flock and yearlings, and let the sheep pass under his staff, he saw Rachel, who was waiting too, and they withdrew hand in hand, and spoke together long over their lot, how they must wait for so long upon one another, and might have no children together, and they consoled each other by turns. Yet chiefly it was Rachel who needed consolation, for the time was longer, and the waiting bore harder upon her soul, since she was not to become 106 years old, but only 41. So that 7 years were more than twice as much of her life as they were of his. And so her tears welled up from the depth of her soul, when they stood apart together, and the sweet black eyes ran over with copious tears, as she mourned, "Ah, Jacob, thou cousin from afar, who art promised unto me, how the heart of thy little Rachel is sore within her in the impatience of her soul. For lo, the moons change, and time passeth by, and it is both a pain and a gladness. For I shall soon be 14, and I must be 19 before the harps and drums can sound for us, and we withdraw into the bridal chamber. And I am before thee, as is before God the spotless one in the upper temple, and thou speakest, like to the fruit of the garden will I make fruitful this woman. All that is still so far away, according to our father's will, who hath sold me to thee, that I shall no longer be as I am when it comes. And who can tell if before that time a demon might not touch me, that I be seized with an illness, and even the roots of my tongue be attacked, and human help be vain. And if I recover from the touching, perhaps it might make me lose all my hair, and blemish my skin with spots and yellowness, so that my friend knoweth me no more. All this I fear unspeakably, and cannot sleep, and throw off my covers, and wander through house and courtyard while my parents sleep, and grieve over the time that it passeth and passeth not. For it is borne in upon me that I shall be fruitful unto thee, and by the time that I am 19 we could have had 6 sons, or even 8, some of them being twins, and I weep for very longing of the time." Then Jacob took her head between his hands, and kissed her beneath her 2 eyes, Laban's eyes transformed in her to beauty, kissed away her tears, so that his lips were wet, and said, "Ah, dear, good, wise, and clever little mother sheep, be of good cheer. Lo, these thy tears I take with me to the field. They go with my loneliness as pledge and token that thou art mine, my very own. And in patience and impatience thou waitest for me as I for thee. For I love thee, and the darkness of thine eyes is dear beyond all else to me, and the warmth of thy head against mine moves me to my soul. Thy hair is like to the goats in the herd for its darkness and silkiness, like to the goats of the Mount of Gilead, Thy teeth are as white as a bright light, and thy cheeks make me to think of the softness of peaches. Thy mouth is like young figs when they redden on the bough, and when I close them in a kiss, so is the breath of thy nostrils like the fragrance of apples. Thou art surpassingly beautiful and well-favored, but thou wilt be so still more when thou art 19, and thy breasts will be like clusters of dates and clusters of grapes. For thou art pure of blood, my beloved, and no sickness can touch thee, and no demon seize thee. Thy Lord, my God, who led me to thee and kept thee for me, will have thee in his safe keeping. And as for me, my love and my tenderness for thee is unfaltering. It is as a flame which the rain of many years cannot quench. I think of thee when I lie in the shadow of the rock, or of the bushes, or stand leaning on my staff. When I go to seek the strayed sheep, or tend the sick ones, or bear the weary lamb in my arms, when I confront the lion, and when I water my flocks, in all that I do I think of thee, and I slay the time, for it passes unceasingly in all that I do and have to do, and God lets it not stand one moment still, whether I rest or run. Thou and I, we wait not upon emptiness and vacancy, but we know well our hour, and our hour knoweth us, and it cometh to meet us. And thus it is, in some ways, not evil that there is still time between us and it. For when it is come, we shall go hence into the land whither our forefather went, and it will be well if I am then heavier with possessions, that the promise of my God may be fulfilled, that he should lead me back with riches into Yitzhak's house. For thine eyes are to me like the eyes of Ishtar, goddess of marriage, when she said unto Gilgamesh, Thy goats shall bear twofold, and thy ewes twins. Yes, though we may not yet embrace and be fruitful, our sheep are for us, and bear twofold for our sake, that I may make prosperity for Laban and for me, and become heavy before the Lord before we go hence. Thus he consoled her, and the fineness of his feeling found the right words, speaking of the sheep and their, as it were, vicarious fruitfulness. For truly it was as though the local goddess of fertility, in bonds and prevented against human fruitfulness, freed herself and made good her loss in the beasts of the field, and especially in Laban's flocks which Jacob tended. They throve as no others, and manifested the blessing as never before, so that Laban might rejoice that he had taken Jacob for his servant. For his gain was great, and he was greatly astonished at this fruitfulness, when he came out, riding upon an ox, 1 or 2 days' journey, to see after the increase of the flocks. But he said naught, either for good or for evil, not in evil either. For the most ordinary shrewdness bade him deal cannily with such a breeder and man of the blessing, if ever in trade he should take his own advantage now and then, as he had said openly that he would. It would have been unwise to combat the principle, even if it had been applied wholesale, for such a man is sensitive, and one must not offend the blessing in his body. The truth is that Jacob was far more in his element as sheep breeder than he had been as overseer of the operations in court and garden. He was shepherd by birth and breeding, a moon man, not a sun man and farmer. The life on the meadows, however much drudgery and even danger it held, was after his nature and his heart. It was a contemplative life, and it had dignity. It left him leisure to think of God and Rachel. And he loved the sheep, loved them in his senses and with his spirit. He was drawn to them in his deep and gentle musings. He loved their warmth, loved their way of life, now scattered abroad, now huddled close together, and the idyllic, many-voiced chorus of bleating beneath the wide vault of heaven. He loved their characteristic look, solemn and withdrawn, their level ears, their wide, glassy eyes, with the wool growing down upon the base of the flat nose. Loved the strong and stately head of the ram, and the finer, more delicate shape of the ewe, and the innocent face of the young lamb. He loved the matted, curly, precious wool, borne patiently about on their backs, the ever-renewing fleece, which twice in the year, in spring and autumn, he and Laban and the slaves washed on their backs, then sheared it off. And his interest gave him mastery in the art of breeding, the tendance and careful regulation of the rutting and lambing times, for he had knowledge of breeds and single sheep, and of physical characteristics and grades of wool to apply in his work, though I should not ascribe entirely to these the remarkable results which he achieved. For it was not only that he improved the quality of the wool and the flesh, but also under his hands the fertility of the flocks increased beyond all known measure. There was not one barren ewe in his folds. They all bore. They bore twofold and threefold. They were still bearing at 8 years old. The time of their rutting was 2 months, and they carried the lambs only 4. Their lambs matured and propagated within the year, and strange herdsmen asserted that in Jacob's flocks the wethers rutted at the full moon. That was a jest or a superstition, but it shows Jacob's extraordinary success in this field, and suggests that it went beyond mere knowledge of the shepherd's craft. Shall we invoke the local goddess of fertility to explain these half-envious comments? As for me, I think the explanation rather lies in the state of mind of the shepherd. He was an impatient lover. He might not yet be fruitful with his Rachel, and just as often in the history of the world, a damming up of desires and powers has found its outlet in deeds of the spirit. So here, by a similar process of transference, they found expression in sympathy and care for the life entrusted to the sufferer. The tradition, which forms the learned commentary to an original text, which in its turn represents a late and literary version of the antiphonal songs and recitatives of the shepherds, has extraordinary things to relate of Jacob's lucky transactions. In its enthusiasm, it is guilty of exaggerations, from which we must not too sternly detract, lest in our endeavor to clarify, we distort the tale afresh. The exaggeration is perhaps not so much in the later glosses and comments as in the original events themselves, or rather, in the human beings concerned. For we know how men are prone to overstress the value of something which it has become the fashion to admire and to covet. Thus it was with the tales of Jacob's successes. The report of their unique excellence spread abroad among the breeders of the neighborhood. I leave on one side the question of how much they were blinded by the blessing. In any case, everybody was possessed with the desire to have even one of Jacob's sheep. They made it an affair of honor. They came from far to trade with him, and if, when they got there, they discovered that it was, after all, a question of ordinary and not supernatural sheep, they forced themselves to find them miraculous, on account of the fashion. A sheep whose teeth were obviously falling out, and which therefore was at least 6 years old, they would buy for a yearling, or a tup, on his bare say-so. It was said that he had traded a sheep for a camel, an ass for a slave, male or female. And though certainly nothing like such bargains were the rule or practice, yet they might happen in trade. Even with reference to the slaves, such reports might not be entirely without foundation. For Jacob ultimately needed helpers in his work, under-shepherds, whom he hired from other dealers, and whose price might be reckoned against the value of wool, curds, fells, sinews, or live animals. In the course of time, he appointed some of these shepherds independent overseers over the meadows and the care of the sheep, and made a fixed bargain with them, 60 or 70 lambs a year for every 100 sheep. A sela of curds for the same number, or a mina and a half of wool for each sheep. Profits which accrued to Laban, of course, but as they passed through Jacob's hands, left a little something behind, if only because he knew so well how to employ it to make more. Were these the only blessings which Jacob's management secured for our loutish Laban? No, provided we assume that there was an actual connection between the nephew's presence and the greatest blessing of all that the man had to be grateful for, and I think we may assume it, whether we interpret the fact in a mystical sense or only according to the dictates of reason. If I were here a mere inventor of tales, and conceived my contract with the public as an obligation to fabricate stories which should have a pleasing, though ephemeral, convincingness, what I have to tell would certainly expose me to the reproach of drawing too long a bow, and presuming far too much upon a credulity which, after all, has its limits. Luckily, such is not my role. I rest upon the traditional facts, which are not less sound, because some of them ring as though they were newly minted. Thus, I am in the position to state what I have to tell in an assured and tranquil tone that, in the face of all doubts and reproaches, carries conviction. In a word, then, Laban, the son of Bethuel, became a father again during Jacob's first 7 years, and the father of sons. Recompense was vouchsafed to the man, along with increasing prosperity, for the unrewarded and rejected sacrifice, the little son in the jar down below. Not single recompense, but threefold. 3 times in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th years of Jacob's sojourn, Adinah, Laban's wife, that insignificant woman, was expectant. The very groans were proud with which she brooded over what she had conceived, wearing round her neck the symbol of her state, a hollow stone with a smaller one like a clapper inside it, and between prayers and howlings she was brought to bed, in Laban's house and in his presence, kneeling on 2 bricks to make space for the child before the gateway of her body. 1 midwife held her arms behind, another crouched in front of her to watch the gate. Despite Adinah's age, all 3 births were successful, and without danger to herself. They had brought many times food offerings to Nergal the Red, beer, wheaten bread, and even sheep, so that he, being appeased, his 14 disease-bearing slaves might not mingle in the matter. And thus it was that in none of the 3 cases did the inwards of the laboring woman turn over, or the witch Labartu close the gateway of her body. She bore 3 sturdy boys, and their vociferous claims turned Laban's dull house into a very cradle of life. 1 was called Beor, 1 Alub, and 1 Muras. And after these 3 successive pregnancies and births, Adinah not only suffered no harm, but actually looked younger and less insignificant, and adorned herself assiduously with headbands, girdles, and necklaces that Laban bought for her at Haran in the city. Laban's heart was as glad as it was given his heart to be. He beamed as well as he could. The drooping corner of his mouth looked less sour, and more like a smug and even scornful smile. Taken altogether, his increase of business and heightened prosperity, added to the lucky renewal of fruitfulness to his loins, and the merciful relaxation of the curse which had so long darkened his household in consequence of that unlucky speculation in the spiritual, justified all the self-complacency the man could have felt. He had no doubt that the birth of his sons, like all the rest of his good fortune, was intimately bound up with Jacob's presence and partnership, with the blessing of Yitzchak. He would have been wrong indeed to doubt it. The better spirits of the wedded pair, in particular of Laban, in respect of the good business his nephew brought him, might have stimulated their conjugal activity enough to open the sluices of fruitfulness. In one way or the other, Jacob's influence was to be presumed. But that did not prevent Laban from feeling personal pride. After all, it was himself who had been clever enough to attach the blessing-bearer to this house. The fugitive and beggar from whom prosperity obviously went forth, wherever he came, and even whether he would or no. Indeed, from the very moderate joy manifested by Jacob at the births of Beor, Alub, and Muras, Laban deduced that he had very likely not wished for them at all. "Tell me now, my nephew and my son-in-law," Laban might say, when he came out to the fields riding on an ox to visit the flocks, or when Jacob in his turn brought them home for inspection, "tell me whether I am not worthy of praise, and whether the gods smile upon Laban or no, when they rouse up to me sons in my old age, and my wife Adinah is big with them and brings them to birth, who before was so plain to look upon." "Verily," answered Jacob, "thou hast cause to rejoice. And yet the matter is not greatly marvelous in the sight of the Lord. Abram was 100 years old when he begot Yitzhak, and it is well known that it was no longer with Sarah after the manner of women. Thou hast a dry way, said Laban, of setting great things at naught and diminishing a man's joy. It is little fitting of us, responded Jacob with coolness, to make too much of good fortune, in which we may ascribe great share to our own labors.